Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your nuclear plant safety. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Elliot Nagin. Mr. Nagin, you may begin.
Thanks, Diane. Good morning, everybody, and thanks for joining us this morning for the release of our second annual report reviewing the performance of U.S. nuclear plants and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You know, I'm Elliot Nagin. I'm the director of news and commentary here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And this morning, you'll be hearing from the author of the report, Dave Lochbaum, the director of our nuclear safety project. Dave, who is a nuclear engineer by training, worked at U.S. nuclear plants for 17 years before joining our staff in 1996. And 3 years ago, he took a year off from UCS to work for the NRC as a reactor technology instructor. So Dave has a well-rounded perspective on the issue of nuclear safety. As you may know, UCS has been a nuclear safety watchdog for more than 40 years, and we have published more than a few reports on this topic since we were founded back in 1969. The difference between this annual report, which Dave inaugurated last year, and previous reports, is this one documents what the NRC is doing right as well as what it's doing wrong. Our goal is to prod the NRC, which is quite capable of doing a good job, to be more consistent in enforcing federal safeguards to better protect the public. Dave will give a brief presentation, and then we will open up the phone to questions. When Dave finishes, the operator will instruct you how to queue up to ask a question. Please ask one question, and if you need to, one follow-up. We'll be posting a recording of this briefing this afternoon on our website, which is at www.ucsusa.org. I'll now turn the phone over to Dave Lochbaum.
Thank you, Elliot. Good morning, and thank everybody for taking the time to participate in this call this morning. As Elliot indicated, the report we're releasing today is the second in a planned series of annual reports on the performance of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, and safety levels at U.S. nuclear power plants. Our report contains five main sections. There's an introductory section. There's a section outlining the reported near misses at U.S. nuclear power plants during the previous year. Another section describing the particularly commendable outcomes achieved by the NRC in the prior year. The flip side of the coin is a section describing the negative outcomes achieved by the NRC last year. And finally, we sum up with a section that outlines the recommendations we have for the NRC to more consistently emulate good behavior and avoid the bad behavior patterns, which will ultimately, we believe, lead to an increasing rise in the safety performance or safety levels at our nuclear power plants. We envision adding another main section in future reports. That additional section will look for trends to answer questions like, is the NRC's performance improving and are nuclear power plant safety levels increasing? Because this is only our second annual report and two data points really don't constitute a trend, this section does not appear in this year's report. Perhaps it will be introduced in next year's report if the available data supports it. During 2011, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reported on 15 near misses occurring at 13 nuclear power plants. There were 14 near misses reported during 2010, but again, two data points doesn't make a trend upward or downward. We've defined a near miss to be an event or to be when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission dispatches a special inspection team or an augmented inspection team to a plant to look into an event or discovery. By the NRC's internal procedures, a special inspection team is sent when the risk of reactor core damage may have increased by a factor of 10 or more. An augmented inspection team is sent when that risk may have increased by a factor of 100 or more. The NRC reported on 14 special inspections and one augmented inspection last year. The 13 nuclear plants that received this extra NRC attention last year were the Braidwood and Byron plants in Illinois, the Callaway plant in Missouri, Cooper in Nebraska, Millstone in Connecticut, Monticello in Minnesota, North Anna in Virginia, which received the only augmented inspection team visit last year, the Oconee plant in South Carolina, Palisades in Michigan, which had two incidents, Perry in Ohio, Pilgrim in Massachusetts, which also had two incidents last year, Turkey Point in Florida, and Wolf Creek in Kansas. Based on the severity of the NRC's ensuing sanctions, the near misses at Palisades and Oconee were deemed most serious. At Palisades, workers troubleshooting a position indicating light in the control room for one of the doors into the containment building inadvertently triggered an electrical short that knocked out the power supply to roughly half of the gauges, indicating lights, chart recorders, controls, and alarms in the control room. This power loss caused the reactor to automatically shut down within seconds. The loss of so much equipment due to the power loss complicated the response by the control room operators. Before they were able to stabilize the reactor, they watched the pressurizer and steam generator nearly fill completely with water, a condition where their ability to control key parameters is impaired. This self-inflicted wound led the NRC to issue a yellow finding to the plant's owner, the second most severe sanction among the NRC's green, white, yellow, and red findings. The discovery that a backup emergency system added to the Oconee nuclear plant in 1983 as one of the Three Mile Island lessons learned would not work if the accident it was intended to mitigate happened earned that plant a yellow finding also. This backup emergency system was supposed to provide the operators with an alternate means of controlling pressure inside the reactor vessel and also providing makeup cooling water to the reactor core in the event of an accident. Portions of this added system were installed inside the reactor containment building. The added equipment included electrical breakers, essentially switches, that the operators could use from the control room to activate this backup system. These electrical breakers were equipped with devices that would disable them if their own temperatures rose too high. This protection was intended to guard against a problem such as continued electricity flow to a malfunctioning breaker, resulting in it becoming overheated and perhaps even catching on fire. But the temperature at which this protective device was invoked was less than the temperature that would occur inside the containment building following an accident. So the devices would turn the electrical breakers off during an accident, preventing them from functioning to mitigate that accident. Kind of like a safety net that protects people unless they fall into it. It's not as useful as it needs to be. While the Palisades and Oconee near misses garnered the NRC's most severe sanctions, it was actually the near misses at Millstone and Pilgrim that troubled me the most. At Millstone, in February of last year, the control room operators were testing the proper functioning of the valves that control the steam flow to the main turbine. For protection of both the turbine and the reactor core, there are sophisticated interlocks that cause the valves to partially close in response to one valve opening and vice versa. This balancing act maintains a constant steam flow and pressure through the turbine, minimizing wear and tear in the turbine, as well as protecting the reactor from unnecessary transients. The control room operators went to the control room simulator a couple of days before the actual test to rehearse their actions. Each operator had someone guiding them step by step through the test procedure and verifying that each switch was turned in the proper direction at the correct time. The rehearsal went smoothly, but when these same operators conducted the actual test on the real reactor 2 days later, things went horribly awry. They turned switches in the wrong direction and then attempted to correct that mistake by turning the switches two more times in the wrong direction. If two wrongs don't make a right, they proved that day that three don't either. The reactor power level, which was supposed to remain steady during the test, rose uncontrollably by 8%. Making matters worse, the operators thought that the power had only risen 4%. Workers on the next shift determined that the actual power increase had been twice what they thought it was. At Pilgrim, operators were attempting to restart the reactor following a refueling outage in April of 2011. They mangled it so badly that they essentially tilted the reactor. It shut itself down to stop them from playing anymore. The operators were withdrawing control rods from the reactor core to increase its power level. During a startup, the rate at which the reactor power level can be increased is governed by several factors, one of which is the heat-up rate of the water inside the reactor vessel. The reactor vessel is made of steel that heats up and cools down in response to the water temperature changing. As this steel expands when it warms and contracts when it gets colder, stresses are introduced into the metal by that expansion and contraction. To prevent excessive stresses from damaging the reactor vessel or the piping that's connected to it, the water temperature cannot increase or decrease by more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. After the control room operators withdrew four control rods just a little bit at Pilgrim, the computer calculated that the water temperature would rise by 216 degrees Fahrenheit over the next hour if that rate was sustained. So the operators reinserted those four control rods to their original position. Now the computer showed that the water temperature was neither rising nor falling. Since they were trying to start up the reactor, this status quo was non-productive. So the operators withdrew those four control rods, as they had done before, and also withdrew a fifth control rod. That succeeded in getting the reactor power level to increase. In fact, the reactor power level was now doubling every 20 seconds. If it was at 1% now, it'd be at 2% in 20 seconds, at 4% in 40 seconds, 8% in 60 seconds, 16% in 80 seconds, and so on. That's when the reactor's protection system stepped in to protect the core from these operators. All of the control rods automatically and fully inserted into the reactor core within seconds. Game over for these operators. The reactor would not play anymore. Instead of the nuclear hokey-pokey exercise, where they pulled control rods out, moved control rods back in, moved control rods out, the operators should have exercised patience. When you're driving a car and step on the gas pedal a little, the car speeds up. It will not continue speeding up indefinitely. At some point, the car's speed will level out at a higher rate. Likewise, after the operators at Pilgrim withdrew those four control rods the first time, the power level and the water temperature rose. But unless they continued to withdraw control rods, those increases would have leveled off, likely at a rate far below 100 degrees per hour. The operators at Pilgrim overreacted twice and forced the reactor to shut itself down. In both the Millstone and Pilgrim events, the equipment worked flawlessly. The procedures were fine. The operator's performance was far short of acceptable. What concerns me about these events is that these are the same operators supposed to protect workers and the public during greater challenges than those presented by a routine test in a startup. These operators cannot walk and chew gum. What confidence is there that they can be expected to run and juggle? During an accident, the operators are supposed to overcome equipment malfunctions to steer the plant towards safe outcomes. Is it realistic to expect and hope that their performance would improve dramatically under the stress and strain and fog of war associated with an accident than it is during fairly routine and practiced events? It's not often that you get an accident that you've rehearsed in the simulator 2 days earlier. Chapter 3 of our report describes the NRC's outstanding results at the Fort Calhoun plant in Nebraska, the Hatch nuclear plant in Georgia, and the LaSalle nuclear plant in Illinois. In late 2010, the NRC inspectors found that flood protection measures at the Fort Calhoun plant did not satisfy safety requirements. The NRC resisted efforts by that plant's owner to consider the flood protection measures close enough. After all, the plant had been operating for 30 years, so whatever they are, they must be good enough. The NRC made the owner restore flood protection to the levels specified by the safety requirements. That restoration came in real handy last June when Mississippi River temporarily made Fort Calhoun one of its islands. At Hatch, the NRC discovered that it had made a mistake back in 1995 when it approved the owner's plan to resolve a protection scheme for key electrical components. Electrical motors can be damaged if they're supplied with too much or too little electrical voltage. Consequently, vital electrical equipment is often provided with protective devices that automatically disconnect them from their power sources if too much or too little electricity is being supplied. When the NRC inspectors re-examined these protective schemes at Hatched, they determined that the features intended to protect equipment from too little electricity might not do so. Even though they'd approved this arrangement in 1995, the NRC admitted their own mistake and compelled the owner to fix its mistake. We commend the NRC for having the wherewithal to see the safety problem corrected and to overcome its own complicity in doing so. At LaSalle, the NRC's inspectors questioned the practice of leaving a test tank filled with water between tests. The test tank was part of the backup emergency system used to shut down the reactor and invent the first line emergency system. The control rods failed to do so. This backup emergency system injected a sodium solution into the reactor to interrupt the chain reaction and shut down the nuclear chain reaction. In answering the NRC's questions regarding this practice about the protective features and the supports and braces installed at the plant to protect vital components in the event of an earthquake, it was discovered that those protective devices all assumed that the tank was empty. The added weight of water in the tank could cause it to topple over during an earthquake, and either the water or the impact from the equipment itself could damage the backup emergency system for shutting down the reactor. This practice was corrected at LaSalle, and when workers at the Duane Arnold nuclear plant in Iowa read about LaSalle's problems, they found that they had the very same solution, and now they have the very same solution. In Chapter 4 of our report, we point out some of the thorns on the NRC's rose. Every 3 years, the NRC conducts what it calls a component design basis inspection at every nuclear plant. This inspection looks at a small, very small, sampling of equipment and operator actions to determine if the facility is being operated and maintained within applicable design and licensing basis requirements. Last year, for example, the NRC's component design basis inspection at the Harris nuclear plant in North Carolina looked at only 31 items. The procedure allows the inspection to examine as few as 15 items, but 31 items were examined at Harris. That examination identified 10 violations of safety requirements. The owner had to fix those 10 safety problems. But at Harris and at the other nuclear plants, it's simply not enough to fix the violations identified during the component design basis inspections. Even for 31 items, a component design basis inspection is examining less than 1% of the total safety items at the facility. All things being equal, the 10 violations at Harris represented more than 990 other violations among the many items not examined. In other words, the NRC's inspectors would have identified about 1,000 violations had they examined every item instead of the very small sample they chose to look at. The component design inspections are not supposed to independently verify that all items meet all applicable regulations. Instead, the small sampling is supposed to provide insights on how well the owner is conducting tests and inspections so as to conform with those requirements. In theory, the NRC's component design basis inspection should find nothing, although the problems are required by law to have been found and fixed by the plant's owners. The NRC findings must also lead to repairs to the owner's testing and inspection regimes that either failed to find the problems or failed to fix them. It's not merely academic. 8 of the 15 near misses at nuclear plants last year were caused in whole or in part by items within the scope of the NRC's component design basis inspections. Because the programmatic fixes that the NRC's findings should trigger are simply not getting done, it's a nuclear groundhog day as we experience near miss after near miss, year after year. The NRC treated its component design basis results more seriously. The reforms needed to decrease the number of these near misses would occur. Our report also faults the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for allowing many reactors to operate in spite of known and long-standing safety deficiencies. Today, at least 47 reactors operate despite the NRC knowing that they do not comply with fire protection regulations established in 1980 and 2004. The NRC also knows that the fire hazard represents about 50% of the risk of reactor core meltdown, and that's when the reactors fully comply with the fire protection regulations. The risk is higher, and unnecessarily so, because the NRC is allowing these reactors to operate even though they're unsafe. That's unacceptable. Likewise, the NRC knows that the seismic hazard at 27 operating reactors is higher than their seismic protection levels. 8 reactors in the United States do not comply with fire protection regulations and also have the seismic protection level impairments. All the NRC needs to do to better protect Americans is to simply enforce its regulations consistently, aggressively, as they did at Fort Calhoun. The NRC made that owner correct known flooding protection violations within months, not years and not decades, like the NRC has allowed operators to operate reactors with known fire protection and seismic protection deficiencies. Willy-nilly should be a cartoon character, not the NRC's regulatory policy. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Diane, why don't you tell the listeners how they can queue in for questions?
Okay, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. One moment while questions come in. And our first question comes from Matt Bondic from SNL Energy. Your line is open.
Hi. I was wondering on the point about the plants that are not at adequate seismic protection level or fire protection level, is there any information about what it would take to get them up to that level in terms of, is this something that's practical given that these plants have been operating for some time? Would it be economical?
Well, I think there's a couple answers to that question, or a couple elements to the answer to that question. First of all, what it takes for existing reactors to be adequately protected against that seismic hazard has been known since 1996. In 1996, the NRC adopted new regulations that said that new reactors have to be designed for the updated seismic hazards. Take the North Anna plant in Virginia, which actually experienced an earthquake last August, larger than Units 1 and Unit 2 were designed for. It was within the seismic protection levels anticipated for Unit 3, proposed at that site but not yet built. Unit 3 factored in the 1996 knowledge. It was figured out how to translate that into the supports and braces and everything else that's necessary to protect the reactor from that hazard. But Unit 3 exists only in cyberspace. Units 1 and 2 right next door, basically the knowledge is understood. We know what the braces are. We know what the forces are. We know all the – we just lack the will to make it happen. If you go back 2 decades, the San Onofre Unit 1 reactor in California was also known to be operating with lower seismic protection levels than the hazard it faced. That reactor was shut down for about 11 months for a combined refueling outage and an opportunity for workers to go through the plant and install the braces or replace the braces and supports with those needed to handle the updated seismic hazard. So we know what the hazard is. We know how to fix it. We've demonstrated in the past that we can do it. All we need to do is simply make it happen. I guess there was an aspect about the economics. I don't know. It is not cheap to put in new braces and new supports, but I think Fukushima and Chernobyl and others show that it's even more expensive to be inadequately prepared when you face the challenge.
One follow-up. You said San Onofre was shut down for 11 months to make the upgrades. I'm guessing every plant is different, but would that be a reasonable timeline for the other plants to get that need upgrades to get upgraded?
It really depends on the scope and the extent of those upgrades, but I think it shows that it's a conceivable timeline. It might be a little bit shorter, it might be a little bit longer, depending on the plant's design and how much upgrades need to be implemented. But I don't think that that time frame suggests that it's a showstopper. If you look right now, there are two plants in the United States. You know, the Crystal River plant in Florida has been shut down for more than 2 years, but its owner still plans on currently to restart the plant after making the repairs. And the Fort Calhoun plant in Nebraska was shut down in April of last year and remains shut down, and you know, 10 months later, likely will remain shut down for more than a year, undergoing safety upgrades. So the 11 months, give or take a little, doesn't seem to be a showstopper in terms of whether the plant can make those changes, take that time, get it right, and then restart.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from David Patch from the Blade of Toledo, Ohio. Your line is open.
Thank you. Mr. Lockdown, I was hoping you might give me your current thoughts on how you believe the NRC, or your assessment of the NRC's handling of the developing or at least ongoing situation at the Davis-Bessey plant up here in Ohio. Some more reports, but in the meantime, there seem to be more developments, too.
Yeah, the owner's report on the cause of the containment cracking that was discovered late last year is due to the NRC today.
Yeah.
For what we understand of it, the root cause has been traced back to a severe storm back in 1978, I believe, that the heavy winds associated with that storm blew water about 6 inches deep into the concrete. There was supposed to have been a preservative coating applied to that concrete to seal up the pores and the other cracks that would have allowed water to intrude to that depth. But for some reason, that preservative was not applied to portions of the concrete wall. It was applied to lots of the containment wall, but not the portion that was damaged. That over time, that water intrusion, that water being inside the concrete, was as it froze and thawed and froze and thawed, caused the cracking that was discovered when the hole was opened up last fall. The NRC is clearly interested in that event and concrete problems at the Seabrook plant in New Hampshire and the Crystal River plant in Florida. So that's good that they're asking the questions and making the owners, you know, better understand and characterize what's been going on. We were a little bit concerned last fall when the NRC allowed Davis-Bessey to restart before they had determined what the cause of the problem was. You really can't say that a problem's been solved until you know what caused it. And the NRC really allowed the plant to restart without knowledge of what was causing that problem. Turns out that it doesn't seem to be something that's a showstopper or would require the plant to shut back down. But it's really best to know that rather than to guess that that's the answer.
So looking forward in your crystal ball, you imagine there'll be a Davis-Bessey section in the next year's edition of this report. What might it say?
Well, the odds are on any year, that's a good bet. You know, TVA and Davis-Bessey are almost automatic roster fillers. So I would say that it's a good case. I think time will tell whether the NRC's handling of Davis-Bessey puts them in the positive outcome chapter or the negative outcome chapter. Right now, you know, if I had to put one, it would be in a negative outcome. But I think if they act on this issue and similar concrete issues at Seabrook and Crystal River, that could put them into the positive outcome. So I'm not going to prejudge it. I'm going to hope that they end up in the positive outcome thing and just see where the facts fall.
Thank you very much.
And our next question comes from Paul Marks from New Scientist magazine. Your line.
Hello. Paul Marks, a New Scientist. I was very interested in what you said about the equipment working flawlessly, but the operators were not. The idea that a test, as happened at Chernobyl, can go horribly wrong is you know, at the front of many people's minds. What is your perception of the training level of these operators, or do you think we need better human-machine interfaces in these plants to allow them to do their job better?
That's a good question, Paul, because if you look at events like the one that happened at Millstone, typically the fix for that is to put the operators in the simulator before they do the test so that they can rehearse it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I didn't mention in the brief, but at Millstone that day, before they ran the test, the real test in the real reactor, they called the group together and they reviewed what they were to do and how they were to do it. So typically all the things you do to fix a problem were already done, and yet they failed to prevent the bad outcome. Each worker had somebody looking over their shoulder to verify that the right things were done at the right time. When the wrong switch was flipped, there were two separate checkers who saw that, and each thought that it had been turned in the right way. So despite all those protection features, it didn't work. The good news is that the equipment worked flawlessly. You know, so even if things had gotten a little bit worse, the Millstone plant would have automatically shut down like the Pilgrim did. Several years ago, we said it takes three things to cause an accident like Chernobyl or Fukushima or Three Mile, and we've compared them to the three wheels on a slot machine, where you need some kind of worker mistake, you need some kind of equipment failure, and you need some kind of initiating challenge, you know, a severe storm, a pipe break, a fire or something.
Yep.
And you need all three of those things to come up bad in order you to have a very severe accident. Any one or two gives you a near miss or a problem. But the long-winded way to answer your question, I don't think you can ever get any of those wheels to be 100% reliable, despite everybody's best intentions and efforts. So what you want to try to do is minimize the time that each wheel comes up bad, which further minimizes the opportunities for all three wheels to come up bad. And that's about the best you can do. In this case, the equipment worked flawlessly, so one of those wheels was not coming up bad and would have protected the public and the workers from the operators and their bad day. That's the defense in depth that you hope to build into the system, because you can't really guarantee that any of those will be 100% effective.
Yeah. Just supplementarily there, if people thought a dial was turned the right way when it wasn't, and then turned it further the wrong way, does that suggest there is something wrong with the sort of human interface there? And do you know if people are looking at the design of such systems to stop that happening in future?
Yes. Well, the second part of your question is yes. Frequently when there's an event like this, people either in the industry, you know, can sell them a better mousetrap, so there's a marketing effort to give them that. Or the companies themselves, they don't want to have these near misses. They don't want to have these lost revenue. So they undertake themselves to come up with better ways. Dominion, which operates Millstone, is one of the better plants I've ever seen at looking for these kind of human factors problems. They have exercises, training exercises, where they put through workers through a procedure that has a lot of similar numbers on switches and dials and stuff to try to guard against looking at the wrong instrument or operating the wrong switch. So they go tremendous depths to try to prevent this. The one question I've asked and I haven't gotten the answer to is they ran this exercise in the simulator 2 days before, and things worked perfectly on both the equipment side and the human side. So is there something different about the control room, the actual control room versus the simulator, that caused everybody to not understand that the test switch was being put in the wrong position? You know, is there fidelity between how they train and how they do things for real? I don't know the answer to that, so I can't say that was a factor, but that's the question I'd love to know the answer to.
Okay, thank you.
And our next question comes from Les Sumacoma from St. Paul Pioneer Press. Your line is open.
Hi. I was curious to know if you have an opinion on whether we're going to see more of these problems, because a lot of these plants are old and they've been getting extended licenses. So the two plants in my state, for instance, Monticello and Prairie Island, they're both about 40 years old. They both recently got 20-year extensions. And I don't know if it's just me, but I seem to get this impression that little things just keep breaking there. There's nothing major. There's nothing that, you know, would release radiation, but it just seems like little things keep happening, like, for instance, the sprinkler problem that you folks outlined at Monticello.
Well, I think that is an important part, because the failure rate for a nuclear power plant, a car, or a human being is dictated by what's called the bathtub curve due to its shape. the left-hand portion of the curve is the break-in phase or the infant mortality phase, where the risk is high. Is for products, it's because you have material defects that cause a failure, or you the widget was assembled wrong, or it, good materials, good assembly, but the operator has a learning curve to figure out how to use it right. The other side of the curve is the wear out phase, where once again the risk starts going up because of rusting parts or embrittlement or other things, other aging related degradation. So, and all of our nuclear power plants are heading towards, if not in the wear out part of their life where the chance of failure goes up. The partially good news that offsets that is that the NRC has a number of performance indicators that are reported, tracked by the owners and reported to the NRC once a quarter. And they look at things like failures that cause the plant to change power by, or decrease power by more than 20%, things that cause the plant to shut down unexpectedly, and discoveries that, that safety systems are failed. Those indicators, for the most part, are not, you know, they may fluctuate year to year a little bit, just, but they're not showing an increasing trend. The exception to that is electrical equipment, equipment used by the transformers, the breakers that are used to make electricity. And because those are not considered emergency equipment, the NRC doesn't look at those, and plant owners tend to not give that their, put a spotlight or focus on those. What we're seeing, what the industry is seeing over the past 10 years is more and more transformer failures and breaker failures as this equipment wears out. Because it's not tracked by the NRC, it's not safety related, you can't get fined for it, you can't get sanctioned for its failure, it seems like more and more of that equipment is allowed to operate until it breaks rather than being monitored and replaced before that point. So that with that one exception about electrical equipment, it seems like the focus on performance is not causing the frequency of events to increase, even though the plants are aging. And we hope that continues. That's a good thing.
Wasn't one of the problems, though, at Fukushima Daiichi, the electrical problem, where they couldn't get power into the reactor?
Yes.
To keep it cool. So I'm not sure I understand how this would not be considered qualify as a safety problem.
Okay, that's a good point, and something I should have clarified earlier is that there's two sets of electrical equipment at the plant. There's the equipment, the emergency equipment, that, for example, that equipment at Monticello or Fukushima that's supplied with electricity off the emergency diesel generators. That's safety equipment. The NRC inspects the emergency diesel generators almost on a weekly basis, if not daily basis. That gets a lot of attention by the NRC and the plant owners. The other equipment I was talking about was the equipment that's used to make electricity or operate the plant on a daily basis. That doesn't have a safety component or emergency function. The equipment that's powered off emergency diesel generators or the batteries as that backup, that is looked at. What I'm talking about is the main transformers that connect the plant to the electrical grid. That's not considered emergency equipment. That's not looked at much by either the NRC or the plant. I don't say they ignore it. It's just to a lower level of scrutiny and attention.
And our next question comes from Pam Sun from Chattanooga Times Free Press. Your line is open.
Thank you. I was wondering what the 8 plants are that meet neither the new seismic requirement and the new fire safety requirement.
I'll have to get back to you, Pam, with those 8. The other way, on our website, we have that nuclear power information tracker.
Mm-hmm.
That allows you on the right-hand side to select various criteria on which to sort reactors. If you select both the fire protection box and the earthquake hazard box, that will show the 8 reactors that have both problems.
Okay. And did I understand you earlier to say that TVA is always a good bet for next year's report?
Yeah, I mean,
can you expand on that a little?
Well, if you look at the the two plants, or the plants that are in the NRC's worst box on the action matrix, their assessment things, Browns Ferry Unit 1 is there. Browns Ferry Unit 1 was shut down for 22 years. It started up in February of 2007, and within years has managed to mess itself up so badly it's right now the worst plant in the country. You know, it's there were more than 100 other reactors that had a head start on that, but TVA managed to put Browns Ferry off the bench and into the game and very quickly to the bottom of the list within a short period of years. For some reason, TVA, kind of like a full-size bed and twin sheets, you can cover one side of the other. They just can't seem to get all the plants at the right level. So they'll fix whatever's going wrong at Browns Ferry, but you may see levels at Watts Bar and Sequoia drop off as they just, you know, even the best juggler can juggle one ball. TVA seems to have trouble with three balls up in the air.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's, when I was a consultant in the nuclear industry, I worked at plants that were stellar performers, and I also worked at plants that weren't. The difference seemed to be how well you handle things. At the troubled plants, management only focused on the crisis of that day or that week. At the other plants, there was management attention to those emerging issues, but management didn't drop the ball in the other areas and didn't allow their performance to drop off to become next week's crisis or next month's crisis. So the better plants, the management's able to keep focus on all areas, not just the crisis issues. I think TVA suffers from tunnel vision. They'll focus on Browns Ferry and restoring levels there, and with that focus and with those, by pulling resources off elsewhere, the ball will drop or performance will drop at the other plants. It's a challenge to maintain adequate focus everywhere, but Dominion and many other plants are able to do so, and TVA's still got some work to do.
All of that said, in your report, Browns Ferry is actually one of the places that you sort of give NRC a nod of satisfactory action, right?
That was in 2010, yeah. The NRC inspectors found a problem with the high-pressure coolant injection system at Browns Ferry that led to that problem being fixed there, and several other plants in the several other reactors in the United States had the same problem. That catch wasn't replicated this year. We found good NRC performance elsewhere, but not at Browns Ferry. They also didn't make the bad list either. They're not in either chapter this year.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Jim Oster from Platts Nuclear Publications. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, David. And I wanted to check. You had earlier outlined, also, effectively, I'll say, deficiencies in NRC inspection procedures. For instance, where they could look at as few as 15 things, and as you say, therefore, there's a chance they will miss many issues, at least miss a chance potentially for fixing small problems before they become large ones. And I just wanted to check as to whether UCS or any other organization has petitioned or requested NRC to revise those inspection procedures, at least enlarge the number of issues that they look at or factors.
Well, I think the answer to your question is yes. We were involved over the past 10 years as the reactor oversight process was developed and as the NRC allocated inspection resources to different areas. It was about 3 or 4 years ago the NRC changed how often it does this inspection, the component design basis inspection.
Right.
They used to do it every 2 years at plants. Now they do it every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
We were involved. We went to some of the meetings when they were contemplating that change, and they convinced us that it is a very in-depth inspection, even though it sounds like only 15 items. They go all aspects of those 15 or 30, whatever many items there are. They look at training. They look at engineering. They look at operations. They look at maintenance history records. They look at modification records for those 15 items to basically run those 15 or so items to ground. And it takes a lot of expertise to do that with quality rather than just spend some time doing that. And they felt that they could have it deliver a superior product by doing that inspection, that effort, less often, which is fine. We're not advocating that they expand how many items they look at or increase the frequency at which they do it. Our contention, is, as we say in the report, is since that is a limited scope audit, you ought to use those findings to cause the fixes to the owner's own processes to be identified and fixed. In the report, we talk about if you operate a car and you go out and you see that one of the tires is flat, or you see the steel belts showing through the tread on one of the tires, a responsible person would look at the other three, figure out, could I have the same problem elsewhere? It's not enough just to fix the flat tire. You need to look at the other three tires and what caused that thing to occur. The NRC just requires the tire to be fixed. They don't require the owner to go back and say, convince the NRC that the other three tires are good, bad, or indifferent. Fix the flat and it's good to go. That's better than nothing, but that's not how you really should handle a limited scope inspection. So what we're trying to do is get the NRC to put their findings in better context rather than just go out and find more findings. If you look at, I looked at all of the component design basis inspections performed by the NRC last year. They found a lot of good things, problems with containment vents, problems with backup batteries, problems with emergency diesel generators, that now have those components better positioned if they're challenged in the future. That's good, but they should supplement that good with making sure that the owner's testing or inspection regimes or whatever they're doing that's failing get fixed too, because that will lead to fewer and fewer problems like this down the road.
Let me ask.
Sure.
What would you, if you were at NOC and you were in charge, what would you do? What would you mandate or request or try to get consensus on?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think if my inspectors went out to Plant X and they found a problem with some widget.
Right.
The owner's going to tell me what they're going to do to fix that widget. I'd also ask the owner to explain to me why their own testing and inspection procedures didn't find that bad widget before my inspector found that. Are they looking in the wrong areas? Were they looking in the right areas but not often enough? Why did my inspector find that problem? I've got a small number of inspectors. You have hundreds of workers. Why was my inspector able to find that problem before your people were? And if they answer that question, then they start gaining the insights about how they test, how they inspect, and the frequency and methods of those testing that will lead to the reforms such that their workers find the problems in the future rather than my inspectors. So that second question, why didn't your guys find this before my inspector found it, I want to know the answer to that as well.
A quick thing. It would seem that NRC, by regulation or fiat, whatever, could implement that, and that is make it part of their inspection protocol, whether during this thing or annual inspections, and basically put it to the owner, the operator, and say, I'm sending you a request for additional information. Why didn't you find it? What is wrong with your procedures?
Exactly right. The NRC's had that. In fact, it wasn't the NRC. They inherited that from the Atomic Energy Commission before them.
Right.
Appendix B to 10 CFR Part 50 was adopted back in the early 70s by the Atomic Energy Commission. Appendix B is quality assurance, which requires, it doesn't suggest, doesn't encourage, it requires that plant owners find and fix safety problems in a timely manner.
Right.
When the NRC finds a broken widget or a requirement not being met, that's actually two things. It's the broken widget and it's a violation of the quality assurance regulations.
Mm-hmm.
The NRC, as you say, I agree with you fully. The NRC needs to make sure that the widget's fixed, and the second is to figure out what the quality assurance breakdown was that allowed that to happen. And if both problems are fixed, we'll have fewer and fewer problems down the road. If only the widget is fixed, we're going to continue to have the same frequency of broken widgets because we're not fixing the quality assurance problems.
And I got to say, sorry, just without hogging time here, but quickly, if Appendix B requires this, well, why doesn't NRC take further action or firmer action to make sure it is adhered to?
I'd be a millionaire because if I knew the answer to that, I'd copyright it and sell it. Cause it's,
okay. Thank you, David.
At the recurring times when plants are shut down for more than a year, the common theme is a defective quality assurance program, corrective action program.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the industry and the NRC are able to spot those in the rearview mirror very accurately. They have real trouble finding those on the road ahead. And these things, and I don't fully know the answer to it. I don't profess to know that myself, but I think we're chipping away at it here, and we're hopefully going to get to a, if not a perfect solution, a better solution than we are today. Because I think that's where the problems arise, and I think fixes there have a ripple effect that pay for themselves many times over.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Matt Bondick from SNL Energy. Your line is open.
Yeah, another question. You mentioned earlier that 8 of the 15 near misses were linked to the as I understood you, the failure of components that would have been covered under the CDBI.
Right.
I was just curious, which 8 were that? Was Oconee one of those 8?
Yes, Oconee. The one that's probably best illustrates that case is Monticello in Minnesota. The NRC found that, or the event was the fire sprinkler system. When the workers went out to test that, when they flipped the switch to test it, no water came out because rust particles inside the piping had blocked the pipe, so the water stayed on the wrong side of the blockage. The NRC found that there had been like 9 or 10 prior warnings over the previous 7 years from the NRC or the industry warning Monticello's owner that that kind of rusting, that kind of degradation could occur, and the owner simply filed those reports away, never acted upon them. So that kind of operating experience, what others have learned, both good things and bad things, is part of the NRC's component design basis inspection. Yet, the NRC didn't ask Monticello, why didn't you? Why did you file that stuff away? Why didn't you read it? That was also a factor in one of the events at Palisades. The owner had been warned about a pump material that was not suitable for that environment, but they never replaced it until the pump failed. The NRC documented several warnings that the plant owner had, but never asked the owner, well, why didn't you read the report that you paid for? So for whatever reason, the NRC is documenting these things, but they don't act upon that. Their job isn't to go out and write an account of what happened. It's to try to prevent the next bad thing from happening.
Thanks.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone.
No other questions?
Yes, we have two. And our next question comes from Jeff Tomic from St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Your line is open.
Okay, thanks. The Callaway incident you identified in your report, I'm just curious what was the NRC's response to that incident appropriate, in your opinion? If not, what should the NRC have done differently?
Well, the Callaway event was also one of the 8 where the component design basis inspection scope covered it. What happened at Callaway was they were running periodic tests of an emergency pump that's normally in standby, but during an accident would have automatically started and transferred water needed to remove heat produced by the reactor core. The vendor for that pump had recommended against operating that pump at low speeds because at low speeds the pump's rotating parts weren't moving fast enough to cool the pump itself, so that the pump was running, heat was being produced, but the rotation of the equipment wasn't fast enough to help cool itself. As a result, the test that was being done to show that the pump was reliable actually destroyed the pump, increased the wear and tear, and ultimately the pump failed. The NRC found that the vendor had provide recommendations. Do not run the pump below this speed. The owner received that information but did not put that into the test procedure. So warnings about the very damage and the conditions that caused it were received by the owner, just not acted upon. The NRC made the owner fix the pump, made them fix the procedure so next time it won't be run in that damaging condition, but didn't ask the owner to go back and figure out, well, you received this from the pump vendor, it had this warning, why didn't that warning get translated into the procedures and training as it should have been? So the NRC did some good things, but they didn't go the full 9 yards to make sure that all of the fixes that this near miss identified were fixed. And it wasn't just a Callaway problem. That's a recurring problem that the NRC has with how it treats these problems and their insights.
And our next question comes from Roger Witherspoon from Winchester Guardian. Your line is open.
Good morning, Dave. Excuse me. Good morning, Dave. How are you doing?
Good, Roger. How are you?
I'm doing fine. With regards to Entergy, you have talked in the past that as a company in general, you've rated them as one of the best, particularly when it comes to learning lessons and spreading information among their various staffs at different plants. When they took over at Indian Point, they put the entire staff through new training. Were you puzzled by what happened that four of your near misses were at Entergy plants this year? And is that an indication of a change in the way they operate, or does it just happen to be their bad year, or what is your feelings about them?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because last year Progress Energy had four near misses at its plants. This year they didn't have any, and Entergy, you know, took over that role as having the most. We recommended last year and re-recommended this year that when a company has more than its share of near misses, that the NRC should try to look at those to see if there's a corporate hand at play or whether it's just coincidence. It could be that due to any number of reasons, the company's not providing the resources in order to maintain the procedures and equipment in good enough condition, and therefore these kinds of problems are manifesting themselves. Or it could be that the company hasn't set high enough standards or isn't enforcing high enough standards such that these kind of problems are occurring. Or, as you said, it could just be bad luck. These are all low probability events, and the company just was unfortunate enough to have several of them occur in the same year. That it's difficult from publicly available information for us or anybody to gain those insights and answer those questions. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and its inspectors could ask those questions and find those answers. Hopefully, it would confirm that it's just random, it's just bad luck. But if that effort does indicate that there's a corporate hand or some kind of corporate role that's a factor in these events, that would allow that problem to be fixed as well, and perhaps prevent problems at Entergy's or whatever companies, other facilities that haven't yet surfaced yet. But by the NRC never asking those questions, they never get those answers, whether they're good or bad answers. They just never, they don't even ask the questions. And we think that's continues to be an oversight on their part.
Considering the fractious nature of the commission now, is it likely that such a group would ever occur?
I would hope so, because one of the things we're contemplating is there are several members of Congress who are concerned about nuclear safety, either because they have plants in their districts or for other reasons. And one of the ways to get the question on the table, and more importantly, get the answer, would be to have Congress ask the NRC, well, what gives here, Mr. NRC? Why does Entergy have four of the near misses? And basically ask the question that the NRC has not asked thus far. With those kind of means, it is external, truly, then whether the commissioners are playing nice or each have their own sandbox doesn't matter anymore. It's a question that's put before the commission, and they'll get the answer, whatever it is.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Les Sumacomo from St. Paul's Press, Pioneer Press. Your line is open.
Hi. I wanted to follow up on the thing that you were saying about Monticello. Did I understand you correctly? You were talking about it's the best example of a case where both a nuclear power plant owner ignored prior warnings, but also the NRC just never followed up and asked them why they ignored those warnings?
Yeah, of the 8 events near misses that occurred last year that had elements or factors linked to the NRC's component design basis inspection that we talk about in Chapter 4, Monticello was the cleanest example of that failure. At Monticello, there have been more than a half dozen warnings to the plant owner about the very condition they experienced, and yet the plant owner didn't do anything other than file those warnings away, never evaluated them, never reviewed them, and determined improperly concluded that it didn't apply to Monticello. They just basically received it in the mail and immediately put it into the filing cabinet.
How long did those warnings, over what period of time did those warnings come?
It was about a 7 or 8 year period prior to last year when they actually had the blockage during the test. There have probably been warnings prior to that. The NRC just went back through the past 7 years to document, basically more than one warning per year over that period was received but not acted upon. The NRC documented that, but never asked the owner, well, why didn't you? Why didn't you act upon this? What gives here? By not asking and answering that question, they're not preventing future warnings that are received by Monticello's owner from being analyzed and properly dispositioned rather than just stuck in a file cabinet. So that's the yin and yang about the NRC's approach. They're identifying good insights. They're just not acting upon those insights to bring about the reforms that they suggest.
So how should the general public think about these near misses, specifically this near miss in Monticello? Because when you look at it, they'll say, okay, so, the pipes were clogged, they fixed the pipes, it was found during a routine test. I don't think anybody got terribly excited about it.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, each of these findings has a good component and a bad component. In virtually all the cases, they do speak to the need for and the purpose for the testing. The worst situation would be for these events not to have been found by testing and inspections, but by actual events like Fukushima. It's kind of late now for the company to find out that its seawall is not tall enough. That's not the way you want to find out about shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
So these events are, for the most part, being revealed by testing or inspection. They're showing problems that perhaps could have been fixed earlier, but at least are being fixed now. The flip side of that is that the programmatic reasons why they are there in the first place and weren't found and fixed sooner isn't being fully addressed. And therefore, as going back to the earlier question about plants aging, these kinds of events may occur more and more frequently as parts rust, equipment wears out. If we don't have our A game at identifying that and fixing that as quickly as we can, then we're going to have more pre-existing failures that may someday combine to cause a perfect storm that leads to nuclear disaster. And that it's too late then to identify all the things we should have done. We know now where we can do better. Shame on us if we don't do it.
And our final question comes from Tom Henry from Toledo Blade. Your line is open.
Dave, I apologize coming on to this late, maybe you could explain to me, the theme seems to be an inconsistent performance from the NRC in regulating the industry through these various events last year, and I'm wondering why why the if there's theories of the inconsistent performance of the NRC, is it, does it seem to suggest that that region by region there are strengths and weaknesses within the agency, or is this a more fundamentally because of the individual utilities they deal with and the cooperation they get from them in various locales?
Well, I think it's, I don't think it's any one answer, but I think it's largely the latter option that you describe. It's the relationship between the NRC and the plan owner that seems to be the governing factor. If the NRC trusts the plan owner, basically that plan owner has at least one get out of jail free card that it can use if a problem occurs. If the owner has used up those get out of jail free cards and has annoyed or pissed off the NRC, then any finding takes on new meaning. Fort Calhoun irked the NRC big time in 2010 by its response or non-response to the flooding protection issues that were identified by NRC inspectors. It's no coincidence that NRC or Fort Calhoun now has moved its way over in the action matrix to join Browns Ferry in the fourth column, the worst performing plant. That company clearly annoyed the NRC, used up its get out jail free cards, and payback was the NRC's. If you look at the plants that dominate the near misses, you know, that get the NRC's trouble, it's the ones that the NRC, it's like a mood ring. That whole NRC, the green, white, yellow, and red, is more of the NRC's mood ring than it is a safety measure. You know, the Oconee and Palisades events got the yellow sanctions from the NRC. Those weren't the most significant events. Those weren't the closest near misses. Those were the ones where the NRC, the plant owner's performance most irked the NRC. So therefore, you get the worst color. Again, it's an NRC mood ring. It's not an objective measure of safety or performance.
Will you, as a quick follow-up, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, with the history of Davis Bessie here, Sam Collins, when he was interviewed by the Office of Inspector General years ago with the 2002 incident, he had, and you're well aware of what led to the shutdown order that the staff had produced and had the lawyers approve, and Sam Collins just had to sign off on it. And after meeting with the former CEO that morning, he told the Inspector General's office that he chose to set it aside because he, quote-unquote, trusted First Energy to do the right thing, i.e. shut down themselves if they felt there was a problem, and he got burned by that because there was a huge problem, much bigger than anyone ever imagined at the time, and he was, you know, embarrassed on Capitol Hill and so forth. And now years later, we still hear occasionally the phrase, you know, they're keeping an extra eye on Davis Bessie because of quote unquote their unique history. But I guess what I'm getting at, that's good in a way, but should it be like that? I mean, if you're a regulator, is there too much of that sense of trust there? And shouldn't, especially in an engineering field where engineers tend to think of things more, you know, black and white of what's acceptable and what's not, what works and what doesn't. Why is this attitude condoned?
Well, I would agree with you. I mean, that's performance should be where you are in the action matrix, what color you get from a finding, all that stuff should be based on objective measures as possible. Mm-hmm. The difficulty is that the metrics or the method the NRC uses to determine those colors are very subjective. You know, at each process, you give credit for should the owner have found this earlier. If you trust the owner, you say no, it was a surprise. If you think the owner's terrible, you say yes, they should have found it X number of times. Then one of the steps is did the owner fix this fully and adequately? If you trust the owner, the answer is yes. If you don't trust the owner, so you can steer it to a green finding or to a red finding, whatever you want. It's arbitrary and capricious is far more refined than this process. That's wrong, and that's totally wrong. That's not the way the NRC should do it. The difficulty is, how do you come up with that? Because it's, you know, the NRC's solicited input from me and other stakeholders many times. If I knew what that was, I'd throw it on the table, I'd copyright it, and then throw it on the table. But it is a challenge. But we need to put as much, I don't think you can ever completely eliminate that factor, but we need to minimize it to the extent we can, and we have a long ways to go on that one.
How does the weight of this year's near misses compare to last year's, and does that mean anything? You don't necessarily want to wait until, you know, you're really close to near miss, because the point of this exercise is to try to identify symptoms before they can become bigger problems. But I'm just curious, you know, how does the weight of offenses this year compare to last year and what you know of the industry in general?
Well, last year there was a much more serious event at the H.B. Robinson plant. It happened on March 28th of 2010. That was on the anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident, and it was pretty bad. They had two separate fires. Basically, every time the operators in control room came to a crossroads, they took the wrong fork. Even guessing, they should have been able to do better than that. And they managed to beat the odds and pick the wrong choice just about every time. Despite that, the system was stronger than the workers, and the plant, there was no fuel damage. The plant was shut down for many months as that those problems and others were exercised from the plant. But that was far more serious than any of the events that occurred last year. But it's only two data points. The fact that this year's events were less severe, does that mean that we dodged a bullet where things are good? It's hard to say, because are we as confident as TEPCO and the Japanese government was on March 10th of last year? For a mature industry, 14 and 15 events a year, near misses a year, is too many, particularly when so many of them could be easily avoided simply by more fully extending the repairs that these events identify. You know, tolerating this number of near misses can't be offset by the fact that none of them led to core damage. I mean, when we're doing that, we're relying too much on luck, and we need to rely on skill to the extent we can.
Well, since you mentioned that, I just wanted real quick to ask, since you mentioned the mature industry now and in the release earlier, that this is too many and shouldn't be relying on luck. The important question now to the industry is, what does Wall Street think about this? I mean, do you feel that Wall Street picks up on these symptoms? Is, you know, nuclear plants already are going to be, even with the recent licensing approvals, there's a hard sell for the industry to show they're economical and show that they can be built without a national waste repository. But if they also are showing symptoms of, like you said, problems that shouldn't be occurring with the mature industry, just from a pragmatic standpoint, does that make it even more difficult for new construction to be funded by Wall Street?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, there hasn't been a nuclear plant constructed in the United States for many years. The Unit 1 reactor at Browns Ferry that was returned to service, and the Unit 2 reactor at Watts Bar that's being worked on to be put in service might be the outliers, but there's not been much of a track record on that front for Wall Street to look at, so they have to turn to the track record on the operating plant performance side. And when you have events like Millstone in the mid-90s, Davis Bestie a decade ago, Crystal River now, been shut down for 2 years due to self-inflicted wounds, it's difficult for Wall Street to say, sure, take $1 billion, we trust you. That gets harder and harder to do. Likewise, speaking of trust, I've heard a lot at industry conferences and NRC meetings this year about trust in the regulator. One of the foundations for new reactors in the United States is trust in the regulator. We would agree where we differ is that we think the NRC has some more work to do, some more homework to do to earn that trust. We don't think it's given as the industry and the NRC seem to think right now.
And I am showing no further questions in queue. You may continue, sir.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you, everyone, for participating today. If you have any follow-up questions, please email me at enegin@ucsusa.org. Have a good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does end your conference call for today. You may now disconnect and have a great day.